This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Krakauer is a mountain climber and journalist. He begins his book with this observation. Mountain climbing is comprehended dimly, if at all, by most of the non-climbing world. It's a favorite subject for bad movies and spurious metaphors. A dream about scaling some high, jagged alp is something a shrink can really sink his teeth into. The activity is wrapped in tales of audacity and disaster that make other sports out to be trivial games by comparison. It's the aim of this book to prune some of this overgrown mystique. John Krakauer has climbed some of the most challenging mountains around the world. He's written about his own climbs and about several of the world's top climbers. His book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his articles from Outside and Smithsonian magazines. I spoke with him in April when his book first came out. In the book, Krakauer tells of times during his climbs when he asked himself, should I turn back? I asked him if there's often a moment when he asks that.
Yeah, there almost always is. And that point is actually, I mean, almost always when you start a climb, there's incredible doubts and you're scared. You usually haven't slept well the night before. You're nervous. You're worried, is the weather going to turn? Is there an avalanche going to come down? But at some point in most climbs, at least long alpine climbs, it reached a point where you have to decide either we're going to keep going and go for the top or retreat. And once you sort of pass that point, say, we're going to commit, we're going to go for it, we're going to ignore the storm coming in, it's this incredible relief. You sort of don't have to worry about it anymore. You get zoned in on the climb. You don't really notice the passage of time. It's just sort of, it's this transcendental moment that it's wonderful. That's what you sort of climb for. You can't predict when that will happen, and when you do retreat, I really regret some of the climbs I didn't do. I wonder if I was just being chicken when I turned around, or if I should have kept going. I mean, it stays with you for decades. So,
let me ask you about one of the climbs that you didn't complete, and that was climbing the Eiger. Can you describe the Eiger and what makes it such a challenging mountain?
Basically, what makes it it's caught the public imagination because it's just so damn dangerous. It's not a particularly attractive mountain. It's sort of this pyramid with a one face has been scooped away. So you have this vertical concave face that's dark, faces north. It's always covered with ice. The rock is not very good. So if you stand at the base of it, you hear a constant shower of rock and ice. It's sort of a sinister, ugly, scary peak. Killed a lot of people before it was first climbed, and somehow its mystique owes to that dangerous image. And I don't know, every climber I've ever known someday dreams or has nightmares about climbing the Eiger. It's just one of those things. It has to do, it's sort of perverse, but then climbing itself is perverse. I don't know, I'd always thought about climbing the Eiger since I was very young. And when I had the chance to do it I actually was paid to do it for a magazine assignment, I leapt at the chance. And that is, having failed on that climb, I still second guess. And I still think about going back someday, although it makes my palms sweat to even consider that.
Well, what prevented you from finishing the climb?
I was there in October. It had been the wettest fall in the Swiss Alps in over 100 years. So we waited for 3 weeks for the weather to get good, but it kept storming. The face was plastered with snow and ice. You couldn't see the handholds underneath. You couldn't get anchors. So we got about halfway up, and we were going slow. The climbing was much more difficult than usual. And it became clear that, when I did that climb, I think I was 30. And at that point, I gained a little common sense, and I realized that this is really pushing our luck. I mean, it's not worth... When I was younger, I thought certain climbs might be worth dying for. By the time I was 30, I no longer thought that, and I thought that at this point in the Eiger, with ice coming down, and, you know, basically there was no anchors. If one of us slipped, we roped together, we both would have fallen 3,000 feet, and you're reminded of this constantly, and I decided that I'd had enough. It was time to go down. My younger partner really just was disappointed in me for suggesting that we go down. He didn't understand what I was upset about. He thought that there's still a pretty good chance we might live and might in fact get to the top, and it was worth it for him. So we had a disagreement there on the face with falling ice falling around us, but our friendship has been patched up since then.
Well, how do you decide who wins when somebody wants to continue the climb and the other person wants to go back?
boy, it can be difficult. Basically, whoever argues the loudest. The guy who wants to go down has the advantage because he can just refuse to keep going.
Good point, yeah.
He can untie from the rope and start down. But generally it's understood that you listen to the sort of the person who wants to go down. It's just sort of when you begin the climb, it's understood that everyone has the right to veto the climb, in effect. Although sometimes, nowadays, in the Himalaya especially, there's sort of a different frame of mind where it's every man for himself. They enter into it knowing that if one person gets in trouble, the other person might keep going or leave that person. It's as the stakes get higher, the game gets stranger, I guess.
John Krakauer is my guest. He's a mountain climber and journalist, and his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of articles that he's written about mountain climbing, his own climbs and climbs of others. For those of us who've never done a climb like this, can you describe what kind of gear you have, how you're attached to each other as you're scaling this mountain?
On something like the Eiger? Well,
yeah.
In that time of year, in late October, the days are short. The climbing was difficult, so we estimated it would take 2 or 3 days to get up the climb. So on your back, you're carrying a knapsack with a light sleeping bag, a stove to melt snow for water, maybe 40 pounds of clothing and gear. In each hand, you have an ice axe, which is sort of everyone knows what an ice axe looks like, sort of like a pick with a droop pick. It's maybe 2 feet long. On your feet, you have a grid of metal spikes called crampons, two of which point forward from the toe of the boot, and you kick those into the ice, maybe half an inch. Often you're climbing on an ice climb, the picks of your ice axes will be in maybe half inch, your crampons maybe a quarter inch, and that's what's sort of holding you to the world. So, but you learn to try, I mean, you learn what will, rarely in climbing do you fall when you don't expect to. When you've climbed long enough, you know when something's going to give way and drop you into the void. So you sort of avoid those situations, or if you think you might fall, you make sure your rope is well anchored, or if you can. Sometimes you can't, which is what keeps the game interesting. Climbing is a strange sport in that it's generated an incredible body of literature, even though relatively few people climb. In this country, it's estimated maybe 150,000 people climb. In Europe, many more people climb. It's more of a mainstream sport. But the body of literature of mountaineering is rivaled probably only by baseball and fly fishing, which tells you something, that this is a sort of a very interesting, complicated sport. Climbing, it's the only sport I know of that idealizes risk. By that I mean that if you want to be a great climber, it's not enough just to do hard, difficult climbs. You also have to do dangerous climbs, like someone might do a hard rock climb, and if someone else does it without the rope, that's considered better. And this is sort of, boldness is at a premium in climbing. It's sort of amazing to me that society condones the sport. I suspect that's largely because it's not very well understood. But in this country, only about 25 to 40 people die every year, which isn't... I recently read that some actuarial experts were polled who... this was, I think, a few years ago, and they listed climbing as the 29th most dangerous activity you could do, right behind operating a power lawnmower. So maybe it's not really that dangerous.
Well, tell me what rescue insurance is and how you get it.
Well, that doesn't really exist in this country. It's in the Alps, where climbing really is a mainstream sport. It's probably climbing, skiing, soccer, say, in France, or what they call football, or you know, that's what, like baseball, basketball, football here. And so hundreds, thousands of people climb in the Alps. The Alps are swarming with people of all ages, from small kids to people in their 70s and 80s. With that many people, there's a lot of, maybe 300 or 400 people die every year, thousands get in trouble. There's a highly developed, sophisticated rescue system where helicopters are always standing by. If you get in trouble, you can send off a flare or radio, and they'll come pluck you from the walls, if they can, right away. And these are expensive. So before you start climbing, you in France, I think now it's about $70 a year. You plunk down your $70. And then if you get rescued, the gendarmerie does not send you the $2,000 bill for the rescue. So that's what rescue insurance is. In this country, there aren't enough climbers. Mountain rescue is handled by sheriff departments who really aren't equipped or trained to deal with it. You're pretty much on your own in this country, which is the way it should be. I think if you enter into a climb thinking, well, if I get in trouble, I'll call for a rescue, you shouldn't be doing that climb. I mean, it sort of goes against the grain of the sport. The sport is grounded in self-reliance. And
Have you ever been rescued?
No, I've thought about it. on the Eiger, I've purchased rescue insurance twice before. I went up on the Eiger, and a couple of years ago when I did a lot of solo climbing in Chamonix, France, at the foot of Mont Blanc. And once on a climb in the Mont Blanc Massif, a long, difficult ice climb, I was getting tired. My ice axes were dull. I was over my head and in trouble, and a helicopter flew by and paused for a minute to see if I was in trouble. And all I would have had to do was raise one arm, or maybe it was two arms, I forget, to signal this helicopter that I wanted a rescue. And, you know, a cable would have come down, and I could have been plucked from the wall. But I thought about it for a minute, and I just didn't know what I was going to tell the guy. I was too embarrassed, so I waved him away and continued the climb. Rescue carries a stigma to me that I'd be embarrassed to have to be rescued. Although if I was in big trouble, I wouldn't hesitate to call to save my neck. I'm not that principled.
Yeah. Well, this leads to something I was thinking about before when we were talking about the decision that you always face on a climb of whether or not mm-hmm. you want to turn back. Well, say you decide you've had it, you're exhausted, you can't possibly make the climb, it's too dangerous, and you're going to turn back. Well, it's not like you're on the ground already. First, you have to get there, so you're still exposing yourself to all these dangers. Are there any simple ways out if you want to bail out?
Well, if you're in the Alps, you can fire off your flare, and the gendarmerie will come and rescue it. Most of the time, there isn't an easy way out, which is why it's so tense, because during the day when you've got cold feet, you're wondering whether you really want to be doing this, every foot higher you climb is another foot you're going to have to go down. So it's not, this is in the back of your mind all the time. You're beneath a very difficult section. You wonder, God, if I climb that, and I turn back, I'm going to have to come down it. There are climbs when it becomes retreat becomes impossible, at least on the route you're on, where you do have to go over the top. Very overhanging walls where it's very difficult to descend an overhanging wall because you basically drop a rope, slide down the rope, reattach it, slide down it again. And if the wall's overhanging, the rope's hanging in space and you can't necessarily swing into the wall. So, yeah, it's an interesting... What is it? Royal Robbins, a very famous climber, once said, climbing is a great sport, not in spite of the demands that it puts on us, but precisely because of them. And that's something that sort of made a lot of sense to me. So,
Have changes in equipment made new climbs possible?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, equipment is so much better just in the last 10 years. I mean, I've been climbing, I'll be 36 in a week, and I've been climbing since I was 8. And in those 28 years, the equipment has improved so much. So people are doing harder and harder climbs, but they're not really doing anything more challenging. I mean, you look back at the guys at Ed Hillary and Tenzing Norgay who climbed Everest with the gear they use. That's much more impressive than the people who climb Everest today. In the 20s, these British gentlemen were attempting Everest from the north wearing, tweed jackets and putties and God forbid. It's incredible. I mean, it sends shivers down my back. So, yeah, climbing is... A lot of climbers sort of rant and rave about how the sport's getting too easy, gear is making it too easy. And that's probably true, but I don't see anyone or very few people willfully or intentionally eschew modern gear for old gear. A lot of people will limit the gear they use. I mean, solo climbing without a rope is popular in certain circles because of it's a way of keeping the climbing by fair means was the term Ronald Messner coined, where you climb the highest peaks in the world without oxygen or you do hard rock climbs without a rope. So, I mean, that keeps you honest, definitely.
I think one of the recent types of climbs is climbing frozen waterfalls. This is something you've done a bit of. Can you describe that?
Yeah, the sport was only made possible in the early 70s when Yvonne Chouinard, a very famous climber, brilliant designer, invented an ice axe that allowed you to climb vertical ice. He put a little curve in the pick so it wouldn't pop out when you're hanging on vertical ice. So basically you have a water, everyone knows what a waterfall looks like in the summer. And in winter, in cold places, these waterfalls freeze into these surreal structures, these amazing, bizarre, otherworldly pillars of ice, many of which, you know, can be 1,000 feet high. More often, they're only 400 or 500 feet high. But it's a really so it's sort of one of the latest facets of the game. And you start at the bottom, you swing your ice axes until they stick, you kick your crampons in, and you just go up. You know, every time you swing your ice axe, you move up another 20 inches, say. You have to be alert. Icicles, as you might imagine, are fragile, so you sort of have to pay attention to where you're swinging your ice axe. It's pretty neat. It's definitely, you get jazz climbing frozen waterfalls. It's cold generally. Sometimes they're dripping water, and then the water freezes on you. Climbing, you know, can be looked at as a pretty masochistic activity, although that sort of simplifies it. It's not. After a hard climb, you know, you have this glow that just lasts for days, where you just kind of walk around in this fog, this euphoria, and that's sort of why you do it. Also, you do it because, like on a very hard climb, you're so intensely focused and concentrating so hard, you don't notice the passage of time. And I've done climbs that have lasted for 36 hours straight, and you know, you're amazed when you look at your watch and find out that you think, well, 5 or 6 hours has gone by, and really 24 or 30 has gone by. You're so tuned in, you're just in another state. It's like a clear-eyed dream. It's wonderful. That's sort of why people climb, I think.
John Krakauer is my guest, and he's a mountain climber and journalist, and his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his pieces about mountain climbing. Let me ask you about your climb up the Devil's Thumb, which is, we're in Alaska.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Just describe it for us.
The Devil's Thumb is, it looks like a thumb. It's very, its proportions are quite striking. It rises very near the ocean in southeast Alaska, right on the border between the Alaskan Panhandle and British Columbia. One face of it, the north face, rises 6,000 feet from the glacier at its base. The other, the south face, rises 2,000 or 3,000. It's a big peak. It's difficult. It was first climbed in 1946 by a guy named Fred Becky. It was considered one of the hardest climb ever done in Alaska. It was one of the landmarks of American mountaineering. So it has a history. The weather there is very bad. It's close enough to the ocean that storms constantly roll through, so it's plastered with rime ice and bizarre frost feathers.
You had to wait out quite a long storm when you were preparing to climb the Devil's Thumb. Is that one of the worst parts of climbing, when you're camping out waiting for a storm to end, and especially on a climb like this when you were alone?
Oh yeah, see, that's, you know, when you're at the day before, the night before, the days before, when your tent pound are the worst, because then all the fears are sort of multiplying in your mind, and you're worried that you might get killed or get hurt, or you're worried about what might happen. So, I mean, I have an active imagination, which is not an attribute for a climber. So, yeah, those are tough moments. There's nothing, you're impotent. You just lie there. There's nothing you can do. You can't even go out and walk around. The storm's howling at your tent. There's not even room to sit up. You've read everything. Every additive to the, you know, you've read the food boxes, everything to read has been consumed. So there's nothing to do but lie there and get scared. It's always such a relief when you finally, you know, start climbing. And it's, my God, we don't have to worry about it anymore. We're doing it. It's, whatever happens is going to happen.
Well, this was one of the first big climbs that you did. This was back in, I think, 1974. And you were working as a house builder at the time, and you'd hoped that by scaling this mountain that you would somehow change your life, that you wouldn't have to go back to the job that you didn't want anymore. And you read in your book that when you finished it, well, it didn't really change your life. You ended up having to go back to the job. And you say that this taught you a lot about what mountain climbing could and couldn't do. So tell me more about what you learned.
When you're young, somehow you... I mean, I was obsessed with climbing. It's all I like to do. And somehow I thought if I just did my problems stemmed, whatever they were, if I just did the perfect climb, everything would somehow turn out right. It's hard to, I mean, that seems so silly now, but I was convinced of that. If I just, this, you know, I'd do a hard climb and everything would be the same, but if I just did a little better climb, somehow I'd be satisfied enough, or I don't know what. And if since I've learned that's absurd, that, you know, life is what you put into it. It's just climbing. Climbing is not life. Climbing sort of I still do it. I mean, but climbing doesn't generally lead to maturity, or many climbers seem to have a certain arrested development. many of my best friends are climbers.
So what are you looking for from climbing now?
Well, I don't use it to satisfy my ambitions. I do it sort of for recreation, the way that other people play tennis or golf or something. It just gets me out into the mountains, which I find incredibly fulfilling. I mean, you know, even if I'm not climbing anything, just to be out in the mountains is, God, it, you know, it really feels good. Come back from a good trip to the mountains and you're ready to deal with all the hassles that come with any job, but particularly writing, which, you know, I've been writing for a living now for almost 7 years, and it's an intense way to make a living. It's sort of, I mean, in the same, it's sort of, as I've become more involved in writing, I've become less involved in climbing. It sort of replaced it. It's the same sort of intensity and craziness, but when things go wrong, you you don't die. You just have to figure out another way to pay the bills. So it's smarter thing to do, I think, as I get older.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Krakauer, his book is called Eiger Dreams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.